CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 110 with Dr. Biren Meghpara. What's the reality of private practice versus academia versus private equity? They all kind of end up being the same, don't they? Well, maybe there is a difference and maybe it's not what you think it is. You better listen. Plus, remember, pow, now we got our Retina Rounds podcast every Sunday, a retina podcast, an hour long with a famous retina surgeon, and they're going to give you insight and teach you so much useful information about how to succeed in your career. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. That is Dr. Biren Meghpara from Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. There you go. I saw him give a couple lectures this year, a couple last year. I took notes during his lectures. It was that good. Biren, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Uday. It is an honor to be here. I never thought that I would actually be invited to be on the Cataract Coach podcast. So I would say, you know, this is up there.
Oh, thank you. If you ask my kids, they'll tell you, Dad, you're really embarrassing. Don't talk so much. But I heard you give a talk this year to Hawaii about a month or so ago about cataract surgery and fused dystrophy. Now, we all see this. I got so many patients with fused dystrophy. And I always believe the old dogma of like, well, if the 600 micron cornea or less, you're okay. If it's 640 or more, then you should probably be very careful. And then you said something that blew my mind. You said, what if you have a normal patient who's baseline 600?
Exactly.
I'm like, yo, I didn't think of that. Yeah. So how do you approach these patients with fused dystrophy and you're doing cataract surgery?
Yeah, you know, so like when I give a talk at a meeting, I'm a cornea specialist, right? So I do corneal transplants. But when we talk, I try to give a talk to what, you know, 99% of cataract surgeons out there can appreciate, right? And these patients, like you said, they come into your office all the time. And how do you figure out, you know, is this cornea going to decompensate or with my amazing cataract surgery, is the patient going to do really well? Right. And especially if you're not a transplant surgeon, you know, you got to get that right. Cause then, you know, you could tell the patient all that you want ahead of time. And if their cornea decompensates, they're still going to be mad at you, right? You know, they're just going to blame you for a bad result. So there's this concept, it's in all the textbooks. I think it's in the BCSC that, you know, if you have corneal thickness greater than 640 microns, then you're at higher risk for decompensating right after surgery. That's based on corneal pachymetry, right? So there's a couple things. And that paper, it was a landmark paper. It was out of Wilmer. Walter Stark, John Gotch were on there, Jeremy Seitzman. And for the time, it was great. But, you know, it was ultrasound pachymetry, but it never took into account what the patient's baseline corneal thickness was, right? So, all right, let's say you got someone with a normal or even a thin cornea, you know, 500, 4 something, and you measure them at 640. Well, yeah, that delta is pretty big, right? Yes. So that cornea is already starting to swell, and you do cataract surgery, no matter how good of a surgeon you are, it's probably going to decompensate. But what if it was like 600 or 620 to begin with? We don't know. We don't have that historical context. Now, the other thing is we're intervening sooner and sooner in these Fuchs patients, right? Because back when this paper was written, the surgery of choice was a PK, right? Yeah. And PKs have recovery times of a year and a half. You know, the eye is never going to be the same after you do that type of surgery. So the threshold to operate was a lot higher. Now we're doing DMEC, right?
Right.
DMEC, single layer replacement of the cornea. These cases heal very quickly, often with, you know, pristine looking corneas afterwards. Some of my residents can't even tell a patient had a DMEC. If I showed it to him, I didn't tell him beforehand.
Well, that's called a junior resident. Wait a minute. I can tell.
Sometimes the fellows in the beginning of the year, we could trick them a little bit. But so like my threshold is so much lower, right? So I'm operating on earlier and earlier cases of Fuchs. So like that decision-making of when do you operate and when do you not, it's tough. So, you know, we use a pentacam, we use Shine Fluid Imaging. And you know, it's, you know, what is easy? What do a lot of cataract surgeons have in their practice? And actually I got this talk up on YouTube, so just Google it. It goes through all the slides, but it's basically looking for areas where there's really subtle areas of corneal edema, and that corneal thickness distribution doesn't quite match up to what's considered normal.
If I look at a pentacam or a Galilei and I have the whole pachymetry, you know, visualized as a graph of the whole cornea, what's normal?
Yeah, so normal is typically the cornea is thinnest in the middle, and then you have this kind of isometric thickening, so it gets thicker and thicker as you go out to the periphery. And if you look at the map, you can actually see these like nice concentric rings if you kind of go on the screen and you have a nice high resolution screen. So if you have someone with early Fuchs with like this subclinical edema, you lose those nice, what we call isopachs, those nice circles. And this kind of pattern gets a little bit irregular. The other thing that happens is you get posterior depression. So anytime we look at, you know, a pentacam, we look at it in terms of like a refractive surgeon would, right? So we're looking for elevation, signs of keratoconus, mm-hmm. something that tells us, hey, look, we probably shouldn't do LASIK on this patient. But when I'm looking at a Fuchs patient, what I'm looking at is posterior depression, meaning the cornea, it's not elevated, but it's getting like a little bit thicker and thicker and thicker there, right? So that's what depression is, whereas the anterior cornea is staying the same.
Right.
So that's something that, you know, you can't see on a slit lamp. You won't pick it up on topography or anything. And looking for those subtle changes, you can pick up really early signs of edema in the cornea, and that increases the risk of progression to needing a transplant.
Oh, that makes a ton of sense now. Because I'm used to looking at a Galilei or pentacam, and I look at the posterior float, and yeah, if it's like a thumb pushing forwards, I'm like, oh, that's keratoconic.
Exactly.
But you're looking at the opposite. You're looking at the peripheral cornea pulling back a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, we're all used to looking at colors, right? So yeah, you're looking at that red spot, right? That's what you're looking for. On the traditional scan with like the original software, now we're looking for blue spots, right? Or look for negative numbers in there. Now you can get cute and you can actually like just change the scale on the machine if you want to.
No, I'm not that smart.
Yeah, exactly. Let's not do that. Right. Now, you know, here, the important thing here, you know, this is like mind blowing stuff and it's really easy to do. And, you know, most, you know, cataract surgeons probably have this technology in their office. I didn't come up with this. So like, we got to put that out there. So this was, you know, Keith Barrett and Sanjay Patel out of the Mayo Clinic. They're the guys that figured this out. And I think it's brilliant. It hasn't caught on a ton too. So I think like the more that we talk about it, the more
we'll
we
make
get
it catch
there,
on right here. Don't worry. We'll make it
exactly.
Catch on.
I think this is like the ultimate, you know, platform to get out good pearls.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't think of it that way. Now I'm a pretend wannabe DMEC surgeon. I taught myself doing about 10 cases a few years ago in my residence and got pretty reasonable at it. The first couple cases were admittedly a little not so pretty. But after a few, you get pretty good.
You get pretty good. I mean, the learning curve's quick. And you know, you said something really, really important there is you learned it yourself.
Right.
Right. You know, I'm going to be honest with you. I did my fellowship before DMEC existed. Right. So right. I learned it myself too.
You did UIC med school and college, University of Illinois Chicago. You did Baylor for residency 2013. And then you did Colorado for cornea and your segment in 2014.
Yeah, exactly. That's University of Colorado. We weren't doing DMEC then.
That's 11 years ago.
11 years ago. And so much has changed. Now I basically do, you know, only DMEC. And I taught myself. Now, you know, how do you do that, right? Like you said it. Looked at a few videos. You know,
watch cataract videos.
Exactly. It's amazing how much you can learn by watching videos. Now, it helps to have someone like with you and kind of your first few cases, you know, talk you through it. If you run into stuff, that's the tricky part. You know, if it's going smooth, then yeah, you'll get through it. But like if things start to get a little dicey, it's great to have someone with you. So, you know, but that's kind of medicine, right? Like the stuff you learn now in training, it's probably going to be obsolete in 10 years.
Well, sometimes the young surgeons don't realize this.
Yeah.
And they ask me like, do you know, I finished my residency in 2000, back when you were in fourth grade. And in 2000, there was first a corneal fellowship was 2 years, and you became an expert at corneal ulcers and ocular cicatricial pemphigoid. That was your expertise.
Right.
So lamellar transplantation exists. There were no femtosecond lasers. There's no OCT machine. There's no anti-VEGF. There's no femtosecond laser. It didn't exist. Everything you had to teach yourself. And that's one of the key things in ophthalmology. You want to be great. You watch cataractcoach.com because every day you'll learn something new.
I agree 100%. And you know, I always get this question and it's, you know, what do I look for, you know, when I'm looking for a fellowship or what do I look for when I'm looking for a residency? And, you know, it's, you know, numbers and this and that. Yeah. I think it's like, you know, the most important thing about residency and fellowship is learning how to think, right? And learning how to figure things out, learning what you're good at, learning what you're not good at, because you're going to use these skills to kind of grow as time goes on. And that's what's going to get you better and better. It's that thought process. It's, you know, how do I work through this situation? Not necessarily, yeah, how do I work this femto or how do I do a DMEC? It's pretty wild how quickly like that cycle of innovation happens, especially in our field in ophthalmology. And we're just doing new things, you know, over and over and over again.
Well, you gotta think you're gonna have a 40-year career on average.
Yeah.
And there's zero chance that 20 or 30 or 40 years out, you're gonna do what you do now in your training. There's zero chance.
100%.
So it's the ability to kind of teach yourself and keep moving forward. And I think that's why this cataract coach stuff has become so popular. I mean, it blows my mind. It's more than 1 million views a month. It's 40,000 views a day worldwide.
Wow.
It's crazy numbers. But I think everyone has just this desire, this thirst. And now we've launched our new Retina channel, retinarounds.com. So now I got two channels. And there's just so much to learn. I just feel like I'm taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. It's coming out that fast.
Let me ask you this, you know, sure. Along those lines, you know, there's so much to learn. Do you think ophthalmology residency can be completed in 3 years? Like, do you think we need an extra year at this point? Because, you know, there is so, and we're just talking like cataract, anterior segment, because that's what we do, right? But the retina world, oh my God, you know, there are so many drugs out there and there's just a lot. I think it's a lot to ask a resident
Here's the balance. The balance is, well, we have increased, right? Before it was an internship somewhere else and then 3 years of ophthalmology. That's what you did, that's what I did. Mm. Now it's combined. Now it's, you're going to do 4 years in one place and the first year is going to be 3 months of ophthalmology, 9 months of, let's say, general medicine. So you're going from 36 months to 39 months. Is that enough? Well, the flip side of that is I gave three talks in the UK last year. And in the UK, it's very common for people to do 7 years of ophthalmology training or more. Wow. And they since realized that was just a little bit crazy, a little bit ridiculous. And now they've cut that back a year or two, so it's become less. So I think the balance is like, yes, if I've shown a commitment to learning eye surgery and a lifelong commitment to learning, how many years of very cheap labor do you need out of me?
Yeah.
The way it works in the U.S. is the you know, you each residency spot generally is paid for by Medicare. And the Medicare will pay 2/3 of the money the university will keep to, quote, teach you. And 1/3 they'll pay you a salary. And so at the end, you're like, you're barely scraping by. To live in a city like Philly or LA or New York on a residence pay, I'll be shocked if you could save $1,000 a year.
Yeah. Savings is, and then you're in debt too, right? I mean,
right. So how can you say, well, so I think, listen, the 4 years that we do now for ophthalmology is enough as long as you commit to a lifelong of learning.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to make it 5 years or 6 years or 7 years or 8 years. In fact, there was a trial of this. In my year when I applied to residency, Iowa made the residency 5 years instead of four. Or four of ophthalmology versus three of ophthalmology.
Yeah.
You have five in your senior year. And that year they had a paucity of applicants. And so there's a balance. People understand, like, what's the math of it? Because you got to think, any additional year you do, don't think you're just saying, oh, it's just one more year. No. Take a year off the back end of your income.
Yeah.
When you're 65. That level. So it's like, I think we can teach ourselves. I think 4 years is plenty.
That makes sense. Yeah, but it does require, like you said, a little bit of self-learning. Like, you need that.
Well, that's for everything, all ophthalmologists, even orthopedic surgery. If I needed a hip replacement tomorrow, I sure as heck hope my 50-year-old surgeon isn't going to operate like he learned back when he was 29 years old in residency. I would cry. So, I mean, come on. You got to advance the technique.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard. I think being a trainee is hard. Being a resident's hard nowadays. Being a fellow is hard. Being a teacher. We should talk about this. Being a teacher is hard.
Really hard. And often thankless.
Yeah. This is actually one of my, you know, I work at Wills, right? So obviously I'm there for a reason. And the big reason is I like teaching. But, you know, I have this fear, and I think all of ophthalmology should have this fear that the great ones, you know, the great surgeons out there, less and less of them are staying in academics, right? You see this kind of tendency to leave, and the really great young ones that are coming out often aren't attracted to academics, right? So we need these amazing people to teach the next generation of amazing people. And I worry, I don't know. Do you see that?
Well, I'll argue with you that the best teaching and the best learning is outside of academia.
Okay.
Now, I've taught at UCLA for 22 years.
I know. That's why I brought this up.
From 2000 to 2022. And I always did it part-time or half-time, whatever time, because I always, in parallel, I always ran my private practice. Yeah. Kind of like the Wills guys. All the Wills guys have a private practice, but they teach at Wills. But it's, if as long as you commit to a lifelong of learning, I think anywhere you train, you're going to be fine. I do not believe the fallacy that, like, where you train makes a huge difference. Oh, he trained at a top 10 program. Oh, please. At Wills, at UCLA, I can tell you for dang sure, every year out of 8 residents, there one or two are amazing. Most are great. And one's a stinker every year. And that's just how it works. And you know it's true.
It's the law of averages. It can happen.
It's the bell curve of life.
Yeah.
But I think now you're not going to do most of your learning in academia. I think where you did residency is as important as where you did high school or college. And that means, like, great, as long as you had fun, congratulations, you graduated. It don't matter. Which patients ask you, oh, where did you do your residency? No one. It doesn't matter anymore. And academic centers have become far more business-oriented than ever. Not in order to teach residents business, but for them to take care of themselves as a business. There is almost no difference between a big academic center and a big private equity group. What's the difference?
You know, that is actually very true. And I see it a lot like that. You know, I'll tell you the difference.
Tell me.
And it's not good for academic centers. The mindset is very similar now. Mm-hmm. And then as a doctor, you know, one of the knocks on private equity is, oh, you don't have control. You don't have an autonomy. It's the same thing in academics, right? Like, I don't have control, right?
Right.
Now, some people like that. Some people don't. But it's the efficiency. So private equity is built ideally to make money and become more efficient and see more patients and do more surgery and generate more revenue. Academics is not built like that, right? It is often the epitome of inefficiency.
But they have an advantage. That's because they'll slap their name on a surgery center. Now it's an academic place. Now it's a hospital. And they'll get 3 times the facility fee that you get in your private ASC.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, the more you think about it, like, it's a little depressing, right? Especially for the academic doctors, I would say. Right? Because it's that, you know, there's this divide, obviously, in money, right? You know, for the most part, you probably can make more money in private practice than in academics.
Oh, there's no question, bro.
Right?
By multiple.
Yeah, exactly. I'm being like a little political and a little kind here, but yeah, it's like way more if you work in private practice. But then, like, you know, if you sit down and think about it, why is that? Right? Like, private practices aren't offering like absurd percentages of revenue, right? It's generally pretty similar, but the problem is the volume, right? You can't generate the same volume in academics than you can in private practice for a lot of reasons. I mean, the inefficiency, right? There's a lot of other crap I got to deal with in academics, like, you know, the perforated ulcers and this and all those high acuity things that take away from your refractive cataract time.
Right.
And then to deal with all of that, we need a lot more bodies, right? Like, I can't do all the ulcers and all the cataracts. So, you know, you got to distribute everything to a lot of different surgeons, the good and the bad, right? Because, you know, you gotta share everything. So you got a center with 30, 40, you know, surgeons. There's not enough, you know, volume to generate the kind of money that you can get in private practice. So, you know, like, how do you fix that?
Oh, well, yeah. Academia made a big deal many years ago, and that is any big city in America, they decided that they used to be, they'd have the big ivory tower in that one city, and all the doctors of the community, any crazy, unusual, very difficult, challenging cases, send it to us, we'll take care of all those. And you guys do in the community the routine type of stuff. And that worked really well. But that's changed now. In any major city in America, the academic centers now have a dozen satellites out in the community.
Yeah.
And they hire the fresh graduates straight out of the training programs who agree to work for our below market rates, to work for them. And now they've gone out of the community. Now they want to treat the blepharitis. They don't just want the unusual, give me the VKH syndrome patients. No, they want blepharitis in your dry eye.
Yeah, I mean, financially, like it pays the bills, right? For the doctors. I mean, that's how you see patients. That's how you.
Yeah, but the catch though is, in fact, the hubris of any big group, whether it's PE or academia or anywhere else, the hubris is any surgeon, any doctor is replaceable. You're no different than a secretary or a scrub tech, and they can replace you easily. That's their idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in practice, it doesn't work that way. I was talking to someone who's a truly world-renowned retina surgeon, and luckily it's cataract guys. We have no idea who that is, but the person was let go from their academic position, like, well to the second half of the career, because the academic center thought easily replaceable. Okay, let me know how that works out for you. It's so crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah, but that's why I encourage every young listener for Cataract Coach, and we have the full spectrum. Our listeners, I've studied the demographics like crazy. Our listeners are anywhere between like late 20s to late 70s. We have the whole spectrum.
Yeah.
The lion's share is probably 40s, 30 to 50s, part of the age. Ultimately, at the end of the day, do what makes you happy. Life is so short. It is so finite. Do what makes you happy. And if you work for someone else, never be 100% trusting. Okay, let Cataract Coach, let me give you the permission. Okay to be a little bit selfish. Put yourself, put your family, put your kids first. And then see how it works out.
That's good advice. I mean, you're going to look out. I mean, no one else is going to look out for you as much as you're going to look out for yourself. Now, you should still look out for other people. And then, you know, it's good to, you know, think of the bigger picture. But you're exactly right.
I mean, in my practice, I put, no matter what, patients first.
Mm-hmm.
Literally every week, I'll tell a patient, you should have no surgery right now. Well, doctor, you're a surgeon. Don't you do this for a living? I'm like, yes, I'm a bad businessman, though, because I treat from the heart and from the brain and not from the wallet. So number one on my list of priorities is I put the patient first, no matter what.
You know, that's a great point. You know,
go ahead.
Very frequently, I will tell a patient, no, that they do not need surgery. And it's almost probably once a day, to be honest with
you. Right? It's all the time.
All the time. And that is such a good lesson and such an important thing for young surgeons coming out, is not to get trigger happy and not to offer surgery to every single person that comes through your door. And I see the flip side too. So we've got a practice where, you know, we deal with, you know, second opinions and complications and this, that, and the other. And, you know, one eye patient came in, you know, they're not happy with the result for whatever reason, complication, didn't like the lens. And those patients almost inevitably will always say that I didn't even see that badly to begin with. My surgeon told me that I needed cataract surgery. And I'm like, really? Because then you look at the other eye that hasn't had surgery yet. Yeah, like they have a. What do you call out there? A Beverly Hills cataract, right? So
I operate on real cataracts, but I know what you're saying. You're saying, right? Like, you know, they've got like trace NS and they're like 20/20 minus.
Exactly. So, you know, it's, you know, it comes back to get you eventually. I think so. Yeah. Just do what's right.
Absolutely. I got something I got to tell you. I started to interrupt you. There is a published paper. You can Google this. Medline Surgeon. Out of an academic center that literally is, the title paper is, cataract surgery in patients whose preoperative visual acuity is 20/20. Here are the results. Like, what did you just type? Like, what did you just, like, put this in Medline. I'm not joking. You'll see this.
Wow.
Like, what did you just, are you out of your mind? I mean, my favorite is I tell patients every week, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
I agree. 100%.
The other thing for patients, if they're like hesitant to do surgery, they're like, I don't know. I just stop and say, you know what? I only want to cook dinner for someone who's hungry.
Yeah.
If you don't want the surgery, I don't want to do it.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, I'll send him home and I'll be like, you know what? You'll tell me when you're ready. Like, you'll call back and be like, you know, I'm not seeing as well as I like to. And then we'll schedule surgery. You know, same thing with lenses too. You know, a lot of times, you know, we talk about all these different lens options, you know, monofocal, toric, multifocal, light adjustable. And that's like a lot to digest in, you know, a 5-minute conversation. If they're lucky to spend, you know, the 5 minutes, you know, talking about that with us. So I'll often tell patients, you know, go home, think about it. Talk to your wife, talk to your husband, talk to your, you know, children. And then, you know, give me a call back and then I can see you again, or we can talk on the phone. And then, you know, we'll pick what lens is what's best for you. And, you know, I found that like that pressure sell, or not sell, but like that pressure to pick right then and there. Right. Patients will pick the simplest choice. They'll be like, oh, I'll just go with monofocal and I'll wear glasses. But if they go home and think about it, they'll be like, you know what? I kind of do want to be, you know, as independent as I can from glasses. And you know, the fact that you're not selling actually increases your conversion. And at least that's what I found. It's just like a no pressure atmosphere.
Well, I have it easy in my practice because I do what's best for you regardless of like the lens, like what will make you the happiest. And for look, a lot of ophthalmologists on the podium talking about these lenses while they're wearing glasses. And now let me not be a hypocrite. Look at this. Ready? I'm -2, and I love it. -2 spherical after the age of 50. You don't know this because you're too young, but you will find out is a blessing. Oh my gosh, what a blessing!
Yeah, I got the worst refraction in the world. I have a diopter in each eye of oblique astigmatism, right? So it just like I got a little bit of myopia, but this is. Astigmatism just makes everything blurry, but I get by like day to day.
My advice is your early 40s right now, wait till you're 50, because then when presbyopia hits, you'll have a little less image quality, but you'll have a little bit wider range.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, it's just the obliqueness that I don't like, you know.
Well, we got your partner's got laser right there, Will. So you could probably do it yourself even.
Just
all right. With the laser.
I thought about it, but it's such a small prescription.
Now, I got to tell you, I've heard multiple of your lectures. This is not the first time I've contacted you. I actually heard a lecture of yours from a year ago.
Yeah.
You talked about doing cataract surgery in the eyes that I hate the most.
Yeah.
The tiny nano-ophthalmic eyes. And so I had to invite you to the podcast because I've heard multiple of your lectures, and multiple of the lectures, I'm taking notes. And normally when I see a guy like you with no gray hair, to be honest, I'm not taking that many notes. But you're like, now tell me, how do I approach? These are I hate these eyes. How do I approach these other than referring them to a younger colleague like you?
You know, small eyes are problems for two reasons. One, there's a higher risk of complication.
Okay? Yeah.
And then two, getting the right lens power is actually really hard.
Yeah.
And it's... The misses, the way you think about a refractive miss doesn't necessarily apply to a small eye. So what do I mean by that? So these are typically, they're hyperopic, right? So, you know, you get like a 20. So +2, +3, living their lives. They wear glasses all the time. And, you know, we do surgery. And if you have a refractive miss, a lot of times the current formulas that we use, you'll end up missing on the myopic side. All right. So like normally what we're taught is, hey, if you're going to miss on the myopic side, because patients are going to be happier, but not the hyperopes.
Yeah.
Right? If you miss on the myopic side, now everything is blurry and it's minified and they are actually very unhappy. So let's take it one step back. So why are IOL calcs in smaller eyes more difficult?
ELP.
It's the ELP, right? So if you have a longer eye and you have kind of a miscalculation of that ELP, the amount it's going to affect the refraction is less. So it's the same miss in ELP, but the amount the amount it affects the refraction is a lot higher in a 30 millimeter eye compared to a 20 millimeter eye. So it's all about the ELP. And then these higher lens powers that you put in, they're also less forgiving. So yeah. it's what I've started doing is if I'm going to miss, I'm going to actually miss on the hyperopic side.
Always.
Right.
I call it the brain effect.
Yeah.
The patients, I'm myopic. I have myopia on the brain. If you got a patient who's minus 10 and you want to aim for plano, no. Aim for minus a half. Because if you end up minus a half, they think you're a genius because they went from minus 10 to minus a half, but a little bit of myopia, they like it. A hyperopic patient go from plus 6 to minus a half, they hate you.
Yeah.
But if you go from plus 6 to plus a half, you're a genius.
Exactly.
You got hyperopia in the brain.
And, you know, our formulas also aren't as good for hyperopic eyes. You know, I mean, we've kind of got the myopic eyes sort of figured out with Barrett and then even, you know, Doug Koch's modification of the Holiday formula. But like with the hyperopic eyes, we're just off. I mean, I don't know. What formula do you like to use for hyperopic?
Now, I have a horse of the game. Here's my disclosure here. Advanced Euclidean Solutions. We actually got just last month our second patent for AI-based IOL calculations with 33 claims granted. That's what I choose. But even then, I won't choose a lens that leaves you perfect plano. I'll choose just a pinch on the hyper side. Because remember, if you go from plus 6 to even plus 1 post-op, I'm a genius. And so same way, the patient who's minus 16 ends up minus 1, they better kiss my hand. But if they go from 16 to plus 1, I get it when they want to stab me.
Yeah.
So it's all what they're used to. And for me, I'll tell you, even my glasses, I'm a minus 2. I wear 175. I don't like it that crisper distance. I don't want
right.
Because then I wear my glasses, I can't quite see my dashboard clearly.
Exactly. What was that?
It's what you're used to. It's what the brain likes.
Exactly. So small eyes, that's just like the lens calc part. We haven't gotten into surgery yet.
That's the worst. You're so crowded. Now, let's talk about these eyes. Less than 20 millimeter excellent, because that was your talk. And I literally took notes in your talk. I really enjoyed your talk. You had some great pearls. And again, I was surprised when the speaker has no gray hair and they've got some great pearls. Whoa.
So less than 20. So, you know, it's small eyes. Big problems, smaller eyes, even bigger problems, right? So the smaller you get, the harder it's going to be. And it's the crowding phenomena first, right? So the anterior chamber is more narrow. You're right up against the endothelium. So, you know, that's corneal decompensation. That is bad if that were to happen. But I could fix that, you know? There are certain things that can go really poorly in these small eyes. So what is that? I would say, you know, the worst thing is suprachoroidal hemorrhage.
Right.
Yeah. Right. A serous choroidal, also not good. Malignant glaucoma. All of these things, these small eyes are at higher risk for. So, you know, I used to do all different kinds of things and go back and forth. So should we do prophylactic scleral windows to reduce the risk of a choroidal effusion?
You do that?
What was that?
Do you do that?
Not anymore. So
why? Tell me, what's the logic here?
So the logic is, so the number one reason you run into a problem in these eyes is that rapid decrease in pressure. So you go from, you know, physiologic to hypotony, that leakage from the anterior chain, from your main wound, for example. So once I started treating these eyes like they have a posterior capsular tear, right? So what do you do when you have a posterior capsular tear? You never let the chamber shallow.
Exactly.
Right? Every time you come in and out between phaco and INA, and even when you're, you know, making your capsule rexus and your eyes full of viscoelastic, you know, go through, use a mini Utrata and go through a smaller incision. Anything that you can do to keep that chamber stable. And if you do all of these things, you dramatically decrease your risk for one of these catastrophic events. So these other things, which, I mean, you can do scleral windows. I mean, that's not a small thing.
It's like, in fact, are these tiny hyperopic guys, which I do many a year, never done a scleral window.
Exactly. So no scleral windows, you know, prophylactic vitrectomies, things like that. You know, I've done a 15 millimeter eye once. And there was no room in there. So I had our retina folks kind of go in there and do a little bit of vitrectomy just to give me some room to work. But the problem is, you know, you don't know where the pars plana is. Yeah, exactly. So you could be putting that, you know, port right through the retina. Exactly. So, you know, we stopped all of that. We just try to do, you know, good surgery, keep the chamber as formed as possible. And that, in my opinion, now is the way to do this. That extra stuff, I feel like it's just we're making it more complicated for the sake of making it more complicated.
I agree with you 100%. Yeah. I don't do any of that extra stuff. And I think they'll be fine.
What about piggyback IOLs? Would you do that? Like, let's say,
in my opinion, never do a primary piggyback IOL. If you do the lens calc, and it calls for a 45 diopter lens, and you know that in the USA, the highest we have is that Alcon Agrisoft, you can special order up to the power of 40.0. Just put in the 40.
Yeah, leave them a +3 or whatever. It's okay.
If you went from a +9 to a +3, you better kiss my hand.
Exactly.
Otherwise, if you don't, I'm going to put the cataract right back in.
Yeah, exactly right. No, I agree 100%.
Because if you need to put a piggyback in later, you can, if there's room, which in these tiny eyes, there's almost never room. But if there is room, you can put a piggyback in, but then you can actually base it based on the patient's actual refraction, which is far more accurate.
Exactly, because we talked about, like, these IOL calcs aren't accurate anyway, so why even risk it? Yeah.
Nah, just put in the max 40. I don't believe in doing more than that.
I agree 100%. Yeah, small eyes are tough. But, you know, they can be some of the most, I mean, like, you take these patients that with, like, +8 diopters of hyperopia, like, they are just completely debilitated. Like, that is not, I feel, like, really badly for these individuals. Like, you know, like, these glasses are just so cumbersome and absolutely no vision at all without them. Like, if you're a -8 myope, at least you can hold something, you know, there and see it. So, yeah, you take them to, like, a +2 or a +1 or a +3, they're just thrilled. You know, it's life-changing for them.
It's also setting realistic expectations. Now, my two sisters are plastic surgeons. And they will tell me very easily that in plastic surgery, you can make a pretty person prettier. And you can make an ugly person less ugly. So I'm in the, like, ugly person, make me a little bit less ugly, maybe. That's all I can see. But I can't go from ugly to pretty. They explain this to me very clearly. I'm accepting of reality. But similarly, you start off with a +9 hyperopia with this tiny eye. No, you cannot have perfect vision. That's not in the view.
Your brain probably isn't wired to have perfect vision.
Right. Right. There may be some ametropic amblyopia bilaterally, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Those are tough cases. Now, let me ask you a few. I got to pick your brains here because you're so good at these tough cataract cases. Now, in a routine patient who has pseudo-X, it's to like 3-4 millimeters, maybe even 4.5. You could probably do the whole case without a metal. You can do you put a CTR in or not? If it otherwise seems like a routine case,
that's like the $1 million question. And I don't. I do not.
I don't either. Give me a $1 million answer then.
Yeah. You know, the reason to do it, right, is if I'm going to argue for the side of putting in a CTR, number one, maybe you'll prevent a dislocation down the road. Okay. Yeah. Or if it dislocates, you could suture the CTR to the sclera. You know, if it dislocates, I'm just taking everything out anyway and fixating a lens directly to the sclera, suturing a lens to the sclera. So I don't buy that argument. And, you know, a CTR insertion is not a benign thing, right? Like, things can potentially go wrong. You know, you could put it through the bag, you could tear the capsule. And, like, if you didn't need it, how big of a schmuck would you feel like that you got through the case and you put in a CTR and you really didn't need it? And then there's a cost of a CTR. I mean, a CTR is not free, right? So there's a lot of reasons why I don't do that. I wouldn't crucify you if you did, but I just don't think it's necessary.
Yeah, in most cases, I'm not putting in a CTR either in routine pseudoexfoliation. Is there anything else you do differently in a pseudo-X eye?
Besides, you know, just being gentle, you know, because, you know, making sure I get a good hydro dissection, not kind of letting the chamber bounce up and down like we talked about, you know, post-operatively, you know, maybe backing off on the steroids a little bit more quickly. Actually, from my standpoint, when I, you know, what the biggest issue I've had with pseudoexfoliation is actually IOP spikes afterwards.
Really?
Yeah, and like really stubborn ones. In cataract surgery, but also in like these down the road cases where the lens dislocates and then, you know, I do a vitrectomy and then clean it all up and suture a lens in. I've had patients with really labile IOPs. So I you know, sometimes prophylactically put them on IOP drops. I use loperidol instead of prednisolone. That's actually been for me like the biggest headache. I don't know. What do you do differently?
And not doing a whole lot differently. I'm not doing a whole lot of the pressure spikes, but then I got a few tricks. When I do cataracts routinely, at the end of the case, I actually use BSS on a 27-gauge cannula and squirt the angle as much as I can to get out that viscoelastic. So I don't have post-op day one retaining viscoelastic and pressure spikes.
Yeah.
On top of that, at the end of the case, I'll often put in some myostat, some carbacol, which will give me a couple of days of not only meiosis, but also IOP lowering for a couple of days. And then at the end of the case, I pretty much leave all eyes, you know, somewhere in the high teen, maybe 20 IOP. So they're okay. So I really don't see a whole lot of pressure spikes. Then also post-op, I only do my special, you know, combo drops of prednisolone, bromfenac, moxifloxacin. Mm-hmm. I just PID three times a day for 2 weeks and I'm done.
You're done.
I don't do more than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So just get them off the drops first, you know, quickly before you can get the typical post-op 2 week later IOP spike.
What about IOLs? You putting in, do you do multifocals?
Everything.
IOLs? Yeah.
I do every single lens possible. In fact, I got a video coming up for cataractcoach.com on the three, we have now three good multifocals. We've got the B&L Envy, we got the Panoptics and soon to be Panoptics Pro from Alcon, and you've got the J&J Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Now we got three different choices. I've been putting all of them in, getting good experience with all of them, and all of them still split the light.
Yeah. You know, I did something pretty cool the other day. You're talking about pseudo X dislocated lenses. So we've got like this like epidemic, I guess, of dislocated IOL in the bag situations, right? Lazy. These patients, you know, they had good surgery, you know, 20 years ago. And now patients are living older and these lenses and these bags are dislocating, right? Whether it's pseudo X or not pseudo X. Yeah. And a lot of these patients have multifocal IOLs put in, right? So they've got like the old Tecnis multifocal or the old Restore, and they live 20 years of their lives or 10 years with multifocality. And now this lens is dislocated, right? So, you know, what traditionally do we do? All right, we'll take it out, do a vitrectomy and do a Yamani, right? Well, you know, Yamani is a monofocal lens. These patients really want this multifocality back. So last week, actually, for the first time, I sutured to the sclera, the Invista Envy.
Nice.
And it turned out really well. I probably got lucky.
It has the little eyelets at the haptic
junction. The eyelets, yeah. So, you know, we used to suture the MX60 to the sclera using either proline or Gore-Tex suture off-label, but that's a monofocal lens, right? And then, you know, Brandon Ayers, Nicole Fram, they would talk about suturing a toric because it's pretty easy to get this thing lined up on axis. It's the same platform. I'm like, well, hey, if these guys can suture a toric, I could suture a multifocal lens, right? As long as you get
video,
it.
I love it.
Yeah, I gotta send you that video. It turned out pretty nicely, and the patient was super happy. And the other cool thing is, you know, if they got an older version multifocal lens, like a Restore or a Tecnis multifocal, now we're giving them like much better technology too. So they're upgrading. And if I'm off by a half a diopter, because that's kind of it. It's like, you know, 70-80% of the time we're within about a half a diopter. Okay, with this Gore-Tex suture technique. So even if they're off a little bit, they're still really happy with what they got, as opposed to that kind of virgin cataract surgery patient. So I think it's pretty cool. I think there's going to be, you know, sometimes we get up there, those of us that like to do this sort of thing, like, and we'll show videos that are like really cool, and like we put in like 8 capsule hooks and like sutured all these things. But like, this is something that's like, I think, going to be pretty applicable. And as time goes on, more and more of these multifocal lenses are going to dislocate. So this could be something cool.
Oh, that's a neat idea. That's a really neat idea. Yeah, when patients get used to that way of seeing, they're kind of reluctant to go back to a monofocal.
Exactly. And they're already used to the halos, right? So we don't have to talk. They know about that.
Well, that's a really neat. I'd love to feature a video about that. That's a neat way of approaching it. But yeah, now I get it, because that lens, compared to the other multifocal, trifocal, has that haptic-optic junction, the eyelet.
Exactly.
So you're using Gore-Tex on that then?
I use Gore-Tex. Again, it's off-label, but you know, it's never going
to
break.
You got to see your video, because the way you thread it is very important to prevent any tilt of the IOL.
Yeah, you got to thread it exactly right. You want the suture laying on top of the haptics. And that's like easier said than done sometimes, because once you get it in the eye, it gets all twisted and some, like a bowl of spaghetti. But if you can keep it all kind of separated and organized, it works. But, you know, like anything, there's a learning curve to it, too. It's one of those things that it's hard to kind of dabble in and kind of get good at it.
Because recently I've been doing for most of my sewn-in lenses, I've been sending them to a former resident of mine, Daniel Sue, who's so good. Yeah. He did a retina fellowship at Wills.
Yeah.
He was just a bananas, amazing resident.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure as fellowship, I had Arunan call me up, who's your director of the
program,
saying, "Oh my God, this kid's incredible." I'm like, "I told you." He's back in LA practicing. So what I do is I see patients, I just tell him, like, put this Iowa power in the eye. He does the whole full part of vitrectomy, puts the lens in. The patient comes back to me 90 days later. I do LASIK to clean up any residual refractive error. Because I always tell them when Iowa power is a little bit too high,
so the patient
-1, -75 is still somewhere, and I LASIK it.
Yeah, it's so easy to fix with LASIK, right? Yeah, it's great.
The patient's so happy. And I'm like, Dr. Daniel Sue, he will get the ball onto the green. Come back here 3 months later. I'll sink the putt for you.
There you go. I love that.
So now I got to tell him, I got to start, if the patient want multifocality, I was going to tell him, put in this power in Vista and I'm going to do the LASIK later.
Do LASIK afterwards. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so amazing. So cool. Awesome. Now, what's your approach for brunescent cataracts? So recently on Cataract Coach, you featured a lot of cases of MSICS. And I think in our surgery center in Beverly Hills, where I operate with Nicole, among other surgeons, we're a huge center. We're like, not quite as big as Will's, but we're probably 16, 18, 20,000 cataracts a year.
Nice.
And I don't think there's anyone other than me who occasionally does an MSICS.
It is such an underrated skill to do that and just to make a scleral tunnel. You know, at Wills, we've got like a global ophthalmology program. So the residents, they get to learn how to do that, which is great. We got a bunch of attendings that do a lot of global ophthalmology. So they're like amazing at making scleral tunnels, but it is a forgotten skill. And you know what? This is so relevant. We were at the ACOS winter meeting this past weekend, and James Lehman from San Antonio was showing, you know, how to deal with a black cataract. Mm-hmm. And he was showing a bunch of MSICS, scleral tunnels, and you know, doing it very elegantly. And one of the panelists, she was fairly young and kind of recently graduated from residency. And she's like, how do we learn how to do scleral tunnels? Because nobody taught us how to do this in training. And this is great. You're going to love this. So Marguerite McDonald said very emphatically, go to cataractcoach.com. It was great. I loved it. Yeah, but that's exactly right. It's such an underrated skill. But, you know, a good MSICS, you know, you sometimes you can't even tell that the patient had surgery just a few days later. The cornea is crystal clear.
Right. In fact, I had a video on, I'll tell you now, because I had one on Tuesday, March 4, Cataract Coach 2493, literally an absolute coffee-colored cataract.
Yeah.
It was there for 10 years. The patient never had surgery, had no health insurance, loose annules, and was going to see, he wanted to come for cataract surgery. And I'm like, I'm not going to fake her that.
Yeah.
I'm giving out M6. Was so clean. It was so pretty. Cornea is clear the next day.
I used to admit, I was like, you know, when I first started, like, I'm this macho, so I could fake anything. And I kind of like thought I was like, you know, this MSICS, it's you know, it's old fashioned.
We
could fake anything. And as time has gone on, you're like, well, no. But you know what helps though? You ever use a MyLoop? So the MyLoop is pretty neat. It's this nitinol loop.
It was not invented by who you think it was invented by. This was actually described in the Indian literature more than 20 years ago. Actually, the lens loop I have featured on Cataract Coach, it's more than 20 years old. But yeah, the idea is it's a lasso around the lens and you can split it in half.
It can cut through anything. But you know what? So you can use that and combine it with like an extra cap technique. So you know, go ahead and cut the lens into quadrants and then make like maybe a little bit smaller size scleral tunnel. And just engage those pieces and pull those out of the IN block. So it's like a modified MSICS.
There's another two. I have a video on Cataract Coach where you get the whole nucleus out of the bag, the surgeon puts a lens loop under it, and in the AC, use just a cystotome to the score back and forth along the lens 20 times and then splits it in half, and it can now take out each half of the nucleus through maybe a 5 millimeter incision instead of like a 7 millimeter incision. Yeah, for sure. But even with a large incision, like a 7 or 8 millimeter incision, because they're created in that shelved way, they seal so well. Those patients see great. I just actually saw the patient a week later. The patient has a refraction of plus 50 minus one at axis.
Yeah.
So it's like bang on plano, a diopter now, but I bet you as it heals up, it'll be pretty close to minimally
astigmatism. Pretty close, yeah.
Yeah. And
those tunnels, like well constructed, don't induce a ton of astigmatism.
And I go one step further. Even though it's self-sealed, I put in 3 10 on nylon because I just can't leave well enough alone.
You put three in? I put three in too. Yeah.
Yeah, I bisect it and then bisect again and again. Yeah. And I'm like, it just makes me sleep better at night because I don't trust any patient. I don't trust myself. I don't trust the patient to not rub the eye. So, like, 100%. With the sutures, then I sleep better.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, those are cool cases. Now, I got to change gears here for just a second. You are an incredible, like, sommelier with wine. Holy.
Oh, boy.
Now, to me, I'm dumber than a bucket of rocks.
All right.
You can give me some, like, Kirkland Signature wine for $9 and then give me a bottle for, like, $1,000. To me, they're both pretty good. How did you get into the whole wine thing? Because I don't know much.
You know, I like when I first started dating my wife, maybe 15 years ago, we'd go out to dinner and she would get a glass of wine. Who knows what it was? And I'd be the guy drinking like a Jack and Coke, right? With like my pizza, right?
Yeah.
So she's the one that kind of, she's always liked it. But you know, as we got older, when then we finally moved to Philadelphia, we found something called the Philadelphia Wine School. Okay. So it's right here in the city. And they do like these one-off classes. So it first started out as like a social night, right? It was like date night on a Friday. We go and they do like these like cool wine pairing or wine tasting classes. Mm-hmm. We kind of liked it. And you know, just drinking wine is different than knowing about wine, and not to sound like snooty or anything like that, but it's it can be intimidating. Right. To go to a restaurant.
It's intimidating to me.
Right. And like look at a menu and you're like, well, first of all, it's not even in English half the time. You're like, the hell do I order here? Like this, they don't say the name of the grape anywhere. Right. So,
yeah.
You know, we're like, hey, we really like wine, but, you know, I bet you we could like it a lot more if we just knew a little bit more about it. So they also hold like semesters. So it's like legit school. You go once a week. For like 10 to 12 weeks.
Okay.
You got to like write papers, take exams.
Oh my
gosh. You got to do blind tastings. So, you know, we did one and then we did another one. And then it just kind of became this thing where like whenever like, you know, our schedules were like sort of like not too hectic, we would enroll in a semester. And it's just, it's been fun. And it's great to talk to people about wine. And anytime we're at like meetings and we're out to dinner, they're like, oh, hey, beer, and like order the wine. And it's been a lot of fun.
Wow. Yeah, that's a neat thing. I know almost nothing. I mean, my knowledge of wine can fit in a thimble, a very small one at that. But the crazy part is I live here in California. In fact, there's a great wine region, just like a short drive north of me, Paso Robles.
Yeah.
It's amazing. There's a region where like even like now the Snooty people like it more than Napa.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it used to be like tons of amazing bargains and great find, but now it's kind of found, and like the prices of Paso Robles wine is going up and up. I mean, it's still obviously not like Napa or even Sonoma, but it's getting up there. But a lot of great wines.
Well, if you ever come by this way, you let me know. I'll drive you up to Paso Robles. I won't drink much, but I'll be a dang good chauffeur for you, and you can teach me a little bit.
Yeah, for sure, anytime.
Well, that's really neat. So you've been taking like class after class. So have you taken like the test for to become a sommelier and all that?
Yeah. So there's different levels, right? So there's like
I don't know. Teach me.
There's level one to level five. All right. So like a level five is someone that like this is what they do for a living. You know, they're either a somm at like a Michelin star restaurant, or they're opening a winery, or they're actually working as a buyer for a big company. Like these are the guys that or gals that can, you know, take a sip of wine. Not only tell you what grape it is, but tell you exactly what year it came from, what part of the world, not only what part of the world, but what country, what town, even some of the really good ones can tell you it came from this vineyard, like this little plot of land. Whoa. So these wines have different smells and tastes that can be very unique to their point of origin. So like, I can't do that. Okay. You gotta like quit your day job to do that.
That's
like
amazing.
Yeah. Like being a cataract surgeon and learning how to do that, that's just not compatible. But like, you know, what I could do is I could generally tell you what grape it is. I could tell you what part of the world, oftentimes what country it's from. So a lot of times what region, not necessarily like the city or the town. And I'm pretty decent about the year, so I can probably get it to within like 5 years. It's something that does require like, you know, constantly like training your palate though. So like studying to do this is a lot of fun because that's just drinking basically, right? So we'd have to study for the, like these blind tastings because these exams, like you have to taste the wine and then kind of say what it is, right? So, you know, on like a Tuesday night, we would have to open up like 8 bottles of wine to like, you know, do these blind tastings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously that's not the easiest thing to do and then go to work the next day. So our neighbors would come over and it'd be a lot of fun.
Don't you have that thing where you can like, there's like a needle extraction of some of the wine through the cork? I can't remember what it's
called. Yeah, the Coravin. That actually, when we first started this, I think we were too poor to buy the Coravin at that point. So,
but I mean, I can understand how you can pick up the clues, like the patient I just talked about. You see the patient in the clinic, they walk in the door, you're like, okay, he's got 10 prism diopters of left exotropia, probably a sensory exotropia. Yeah. You look at the microscope, you're like, okay, you got a very brunescent cataract, you've got like 3 to 4 clockers of Zion loss. Let me put up a gonio mirror. You've got angle recession there. You're like, his left eye, let me guess, did you ever catch a right hook?
Exactly.
Yeah, how did you know someone punched me in the eye? Like, yeah, I know a thing or two.
Yeah, no, it's a lot, you know, like picking out wines and kind of doing that. It's a lot like being a doctor. Like, you have to be very observant. And it's like deductive thinking. Like, you put these like 5 different clues together, and then that's the wine.
Oh, that is so cool. That is awesome. Well, Brant, I can't believe it's been a whole hour we've been talking. We've been chit-chatting.
Has it been an hour?
Beeren's been a whole hour. Can you imagine that?
Oh my God.
Did you see we just have
time flies.
Now, is there anything else we need to cover here? But we talked about some fun challenging cataract cases. We talked about the whole challenge of academia, lifelong learning. We talked about the wine. What do we miss out here? Anything?
I don't think so. That was a lot. That's a lot. We covered it in an hour.
It's fun stuff. Well, I want to thank you. What an incredible fun hour. You certainly listen. I think if any of my audience members ever has Beeren on the program to speak, I promise his lectures are that good that I literally took notes 2 years in a row, which is why I had to have him on the podcast.
I appreciate it. Thank you. That means a lot, honestly.
No, that's a rare compliment because like you just come with a different way of looking at things. And so like things we talk about, like the dogma of like, no, but 640 microns or more for Fuchs. You're like, wait a minute, what if you start off at 490? Yeah. And it's like, as simple as that sounds, I'm so dumb. I never even thought of that. I'm like, duh. I mean, like, hello. I didn't think of it till now, till you said it. So great pros again. Thank you so much. Owner, minor, listeners and viewers, remember, I got a new podcast every single Sunday. We're at more than 100 podcasts and going. We've got a new cataract coach video every single day. Remember, we also now have a retina video, retinarounds.com, new video every single day. And the Retina Rounds podcast, including the business aspects of ophthalmology, is coming up soon. Until next week, I'll catch you later.